Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Before we jump into a conversation about what's happening on the national political scene, we're going to, I'm going to remind you that and invite you, all of you, to join me for the 10th annual Annapolis Summit that will take place next Wednesday, January the 9th at 7 a.m., from 7 to 9 a.m., 7 to 10 a.m., actually, at the Governor Calvert House. 7 a.m. is breakfast. At 8 a.m., we have a conversation with Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush. And then we have a one-on-one conversation with Governor Martin O'Malley. We want you to join us in the audience and ask the questions you want to ask of our political leaders about where they're taking the state of Maryland, what's on your mind. The mics will be open, and you can be part of it. Just call 410-454-0500. That's 410-454-0500 for ticket information, or go to hfishman at biz, B-I-Z, at bizjournals.com. And reserve your place. Join us in Annapolis next January 9th, next week on Wednesday morning. We look forward to having you there with us for that conversation and breakfast with our three state political leaders. We are going to turn this conversation now more to national political questions. We are joined here in the studio by Dr. Kimberly Moffitt. Kimberly Moffitt is Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC and has been in the studio often talking about many things, race, culture, politics, history. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
Bob Summerby is with us, editor of the Daily Howler, who's been coming on the show now for 20 years, which is a frightening thought, but here he is.
You say it every time.
I do. It's true, though. It's not so
I'm just really. A scary person. That's obvious.
Dr. Richard Vats with us. Rick Vats also is a longtime guest here, distinguished professor in the Department of Mass Communications and Communication Studies at Taos University.
And author of?
You tell them.
The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. It's a great book, and I am very humble
about
name? It.
What's the title of the book?
That is the only authentic, is the title. Shoya Honkler is with us, who is vice president of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and former vice presidential candidate in this last election on the Green Party ticket. And Sherry, good to have you back on the show once again. Welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
And Lenny McAllister joins us by phone. Lenny's from joining us from Washington. I think he's in Washington. Conservative media personality, public speaker, writer. Lenny, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I'm actually bouncing back and forth between Chicago and Washington, as a matter of fact, going back and forth. Today I'm on the East Coast, but I'll be going back home soon.
There you go. So just all over the place. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So let's talk. We're trying to get some gun control in a little bit, to talk a bit about where that might take Congress. That'll be one of the issues. But right now it seems like the only issue Congress will be wrestling with come the new Congress coming in will be this fiscal cliff, which they tripped over, it seemed. But what they're going to face in a month or 2 months could be much more of a decisive debate. And not much happened here. And let me turn to Bob Summerby first.
Well, not a great deal happened here. Gee, Mark, I don't know what to tell. You know, I come at this from the press standpoint, not so much from the standpoint of who won and who lost, who got what he wanted, who didn't get what they wanted. As I come more from the standpoint of what kind of discussion have we had, and does anyone have any idea what's going on at all? How many people understand that 77% of people will be paying more tax this year, not just the 2% that we've heard about because of the payroll thing? I would guess a lot of people don't understand that because of the rhetoric surrounding this whole discussion. You know, this is likely, this will be potentially messier and uglier in the next couple of months because we now have the debt limit hanging out there, and that's a much more serious cliff to go over than the slightly hyped fiscal cliff that we tumbled over briefly on New Year's Eve. Many people were not in a state to realize we had fallen over the cliff. They were falling over their own daiquiri cliffs and on New Year's Eve. What's going to come up in the next couple of months is they try to settle the spending issues with the threat of a debt limit problem lying out there, and it's going to be another mess. And as a nation, we just aren't having a very sensible discussion about these things, in my opinion. You know, you have to decide how much revenue do you need to run a nation, and once you've sort of got a rough idea about that, you have to figure out who's going to provide it. This is pretty simple blocking and tackling. That's just not going on. It's all hand-to-hand fighting about Obama versus Boehner. And I just don't think we're having a very constructive discussion. And it's not likely to get better.
Lenny McAllister, let me go to you next. We'll go around the room, then we'll jump into a crossways conversation here. Open the phones at 410-319-8888. Lenny?
Well, nobody won. I did my McAllister minute for this week, and I basically said nobody won. President Obama, who has this schizophrenic love-hate affair with the Bush tax cuts and that $250,000 level. In 2008, he campaigned against it. In 2010, he extended it, signed it back into law. In 2012, he campaigned against it. And in 2013, he pushed it up to $450,000. And I think that he may have even gone up or gotten closer to $1 million if the Republicans had jumped at the deal a little earlier in this process. And this is the same thing that we saw last year, where the Republicans, generally speaking, did not recognize when they won. They really wanted to stick it to the Democrats rather than taking a win and being methodical with how we turn this huge problem that we're facing around economically. And therefore, you have the Democrats who are not happy. You have the Republicans who are not happy. And you saw that with some of the voting. You're seeing that today with Governor Chris Christie. And you have the American people who all of their taxes go up. The top 2% have income taxes go up. And we're still not talking about the sequester. We're still not talking about reducing spending because we're adding $4 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years. And we're not talking about, are these things going to help put people back to work, which is still the number one issue that we're all facing.
Dr. Kimberly Muffet.
Well, I have to say, on very few occasions is this the case, but I actually agree with Lenny.
Uh-oh.
And think... he's hit many of the points dead on, and I guess from a media critic perspective, I've just been irritated by the amount of rhetoric around the conversation that has kept us from actually getting any work done. And certainly in terms of what the average American knows, not giving them the information so that we do feel informed about what really is this fiscal cliff, and is it really something that will directly impact us? So I think that's probably the aspect of it that has been unsettling to me. But in fact, I do agree with Lenny.
Let's go to Rick Batch, and then we'll go to Sherry Hunkler. Rick.
Well, let me recommend two articles to your listeners, one by David Brooks in the New York Times today and one by Robert Samuelson yesterday in the Washington Post. Brooks says that the deal raises $600 billion while accruing $8 trillion in new debt at the same time. Samuelson talks about the fact that until we do something about the spending, until we become serious about the spending, we've got this gigantic $16.4 trillion debt that is facing the country that is eventually going to bankrupt the country. He says that he makes a lot of arguments in yesterday's piece that I just think is a wonderful, wonderful piece.
Rick, you want to read into the microphone, not your script?
I'm sorry.
So we can see what, if we know what you're saying.
Well, okay. he talks about the richest 5% paying 40% of federal taxes, 1%. 1% of the public pays 22% of federal income taxes. And I think people are thinking that we're going to really suck to the rich who are getting away with not paying any income taxes. It's a myth. It's just not true. And it seems to me that the president simply wants to maintain the rich as the boogeyman, as the devil figure, and doesn't want to deal with this problem. The problem is entitlements. It's entitlements. Those three things.
So let me go to Sherry Hunkler.
The rich are the boogeyman. And quite frankly, this has been a bipartisan assault on the American people. And the reason that this has happened is because Obama backed off of his promise to raise taxes for the top 2%. He only repealed the Bush tax cuts for the 1.5%, those earning over $400,000 a year. We could have raised over $1.2 trillion in revenue if he had gone ahead and done that. And instead, we've manufactured a crisis, and we pretend like there's not enough money to go around. Well, there's plenty of money to go around. Goldman Sachs just got $1.6 billion in tax-free financing for its new headquarters. NASCAR just got $43 million in tax breaks over the last 2 years. Hollywood Studios just received $150 million in tax breaks over through 2010 and 2011. And nobody seems to be talking about the real crisis in this country, which is, you know, there's still men, women, and children right now that are living in New York City with no heat, no running water, and are at risk of hypothermia. And we have a serious climate crisis at hand. And the majority of us are living in a Great Depression, and we don't have the kind of jobs that this country needs.
So, okay, Kimberly, okay, were you about to say something?
Nope.
Okay, I thought you were. Just had that look in your face. You're about to jump in.
Love the boogeyman comment.
I do too.
It's a great comment. It just isn't true. I mean, the fact is that among Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, you've got 44% of non-interest federal spending. And until we do something about that, and it's going to go up and up, and until we do something about that, we're not going to be able to significantly deal with the debt. And you can look at $150 million and think that's significant, but it's just not significant. The question is, are we serious about the problem, or do we simply want to find devil figures that all hate?
Well, I mean, let's take a look back at some of these. The Social Security was taken off the table in this particular round of conversations, only for a moment. But the federal government, what does the federal government owe the Social Security Trust Fund? Anyone take a guess?
Well, the federal government has been borrowing from the Social Security trustees as they borrow from other institutions all over the world. It's not wise to single out that one particular source of borrowing.
Well, it is because they want to cut Social Security. That's the big mantra, to cut Social Security. But
I'm not in favor of, by the way.
$2 trillion in borrowing from Social Security.
Fine, pay it back. Like they're going to pay back all the time.
Every old person in the country five times over without any worry about taking care of Social Security.
The fact is people receive so much more from Social Security than they ever put in.
That's not the point.
Why isn't that the point?
The point is, are we a society that can take care of senior citizens, people in need, or not?
Well, no, because the senior citizens begin to adjust to the amount that you're giving them. And when you give them...
All right, Richard. All right now.
I'm sorry. I love you, Richard. That just hit me.
I get that all the time.
You're 70
years old.
There is some truth to that remark, by the way.
Adjust to that poverty. Please, adjust to it.
No, do you think all Social Security recipients are in poverty?
No, and by the way, it's possible to reduce spending on Social Security by limiting payments to higher earners among Social Security recipients.
And the perception of Social Security recipients is that what they're receiving is what they put in plus interest. And it's simply not true, because Social Security recipients are living so much longer, and there are adjustments made periodically to Social Security. They receive a tremendous amount more than they put in plus
and
interest.
And who cares? So
but
what?
It all depends on the population, too. If you start talking about African-Americans, specifically African-American men, you know, you have a population that, especially if you raise the age, which I think it's something that should be considered, but if you're going to raise the age and keep the current social conditions we have in place, there's plenty of African-Americans, due to poor health and the disparities we are continuing to see throughout our nation, that don't get those benefits. So as we look at the cost curve with Social Security, I think the backside of that is going to Generation X and Generation Y, those millennials, and saying, we're going to put sound fiscal policies into place to bring about good jobs so that as we increase the Social Security age, you're not taking as much out of it as we're projecting right now, and you can be in good jobs for a longer period of time. Because part of the equation is we're not able to pay into it the way we need to because the jobs and the income, the revenue, is not there. And it's not just a matter of taxing the rich. You have to make sure that the working class are able to take care of themselves and that they're able to move into the middle class. And right now, no one's talking about those policies either.
And by the way, Social Security is a relatively small part of the long-run problem. Everyone agrees on almost all sides of the discussion. Right. Everyone agrees that it's Medicare and Medicaid. health spending, that's the gigantic part of future.
Relatively, yeah. But Social Security is not insignificant.
It sort of is. It's relatively. It's not a huge thing. And if you could get Medicare and Medicaid under control, Social Security would be pretty easily fixed. And so that's just a question of, why are we spending so much on health care in this country? It's often said by economist Dean Baker, if we spent per person on health care what other developed nations spend, we would be the federal government would be running surpluses right now because it's all the spending is all excess medical spending. Where is all that money going? You can't find a discussion of that in the mainstream press corps. We spent a whole year in 2009 pretending to discuss health care. Go ahead and find a discussion in the New York Times or the Washington Post where anyone discussed where all that extra – we're spending twice as much, 2 to 3 times as much per person as what other developed nations spend. Where is that money going? Big newspapers won't discuss it.
They often don't read it, like the contents of Obamacare. They're just not read.
But that's not, that's to come back to the point that Bob is reading, which is more the raise. And let me go to Sherry with a response and then come around the room. Sherry?
This all goes, it's hard for me to participate in the conversation because the other discussion that's not really taking place is, not only are corporations and banks not paying their fair share, in the 40s, corporations paid 50% more taxes than individuals. Today, they pay 75% less than individuals. And so this whole conversation about who pays more and that kind of stuff, it's really a larger conversation about are we going to care for our seniors? Are we going to provide public education? Are we going to take care of our earth that is in crisis with this climate crisis? This whole thing about, raising the age for Social Security so that we have to, work until we're 100 and receive the few dollars that we receive is absolutely ridiculous. We could create many more jobs. We could green America, and we could put everybody to work, and we could put families into all of the abandoned houses that exist in this country and start a public works program if we really develop the political will. So it's hard for me to proceed from this notion of scarcity when I think that there is an abundance that goes around.
I agree.
And it's, mixed up priorities. And I think our elderly and our children and our planet, for that matter, deserve that from all of us.
I think that's the other discussion that isn't taking place on the revenue side is looking at what has happened to revenue sources in our federal government over the past, let's say, 40 years. High earners are paying much less than they've paid in the past. And if you even – where's even a discussion about what our situation would look like if we just went back to the Clinton tax rates? I mean, that would end the deficit problem. Just the rates we were all living under in 1999 and 2000, it wouldn't end deficits. It would end the deficit alleged crisis. But what kind of tax rates were being paid by wealthy people and corporations 30, 40 years ago compared to today? There's been a mania about tax cuts in this country. It's been the American political religion for the last 30 or 40 years. It controls every discussion that goes on. So on the revenue side, that's the other discussion, where everything is controlled by the miracle of the last dozen years was the President Obama came along, and from the time he ran for president, he endorsed 80% of the Bush tax cuts, which every Democrat was against in 2000. So in the course of 8 years, Democrats went from opposing the Bush tax cuts to supporting the idea that 80% of the money has to be extended on 98% of the people who receive the tax cuts. That was a gigantic change in Democratic Party politics.
Well, if you weaken the economy, you'll have fewer jobs or you'll have fewer well-paying jobs. And to deny that, you have to deny that in order to sustain your argument.
Understood, but at some point you decide how much revenue do you need and how much revenue
True, but you also have to look at the economic, to build off of that point, you also have to look at the economic environment that we're dealing with. 30, 40, 50 years ago, we basically were it. I mean, and aside from a few Western Europe trade partners, this wasn't the global economy that we're dealing with now. I mean, all those high-paying jobs that were just referenced, the engineering jobs, there was no such thing as technology. Therefore, the world was not as connected as it is now. We have seen a lot of our jobs be shipped off. And again, it goes back to policy. Yes, we can tax people at the high end, and they'll do what the banks did. They will take the the money they have and they will sit on it. That is not what we need in this economy. Look at what happened with the bank bailouts. We gave them money for two things: unfreeze the credit markets for small businesses and make sure that people can stay at work and people can access capital after the crisis of 2008. What transpired? The banks took the money and bought up vulnerable banks. What do we think private individuals are going to do if we just try to take more and more and more from tax revenue? Yes, we'll get more in the coffers and they'll sit on the money more. That is not going to regrow this economy. We have to get both public and private institutions to be able to get the economy going with the money circulating and hitting more hands throughout our society.
So, Sherry, let me get you back on that to respond to what you just heard. Because I'm curious where you think how that changes, where it goes. And I want to hear what Kimberly says about, well, because we haven't heard in a few minutes either. Sherry?
Well, I just think that, we all have a responsibility to pay taxes and to, build schools as opposed to building prisons, providing health care. We proceed from this idea that, food, clothing, and housing and all the various different basic necessities of life shouldn't be up for negotiations. And, we live in an affluent country, and there's no reason why people can't have access to all of these things. We don't have a problem of lazy people in this country that aren't willing to go to work. We just haven't been serious about creating the kind of jobs that need to be created out there. And that's where our money should go. It's going to in this country. We have more people in prison in this country than any other place in the entire world. And, we don't really invest in our children. People don't have a right to education. Most of our students, if they go to college, as soon as they graduate, the number one thing is how the hell they're going to deal with their student debt. Things don't have to be like this. We could deal with this climate crisis by greening the economy, by coming up with green jobs. By taking the unemployed and taking the employment the unemployment centers and turning them into employment centers, and we wouldn't be having.
What is that? Tell me what that means. What does that mean? Taking unemployment centers and turning them into employment centers.
Similar.
That was Rick
Vatz
asking the question.
That is I asking the question.
Similar to the public works jobs. Where, instead of going down and collecting your unemployment check, you would go down to the employment center and there would be a job there for you. And there would also be a paycheck there for you and your family. And that would come out of our taxes.
So we're going to take a break here in a minute, but I really want to, and I'm going to go to the phones. I want to hear Betty's called in, Hank's called in, get their comments on the air. But I think part of the missing conversation here that we had the last time we had several economists and people who do a lot of economic writing on the show talk about the fiscal cliff. And from conservative to liberal to left, all the commentators that day ended up saying one thing in common. Nobody's asking the right questions. Nobody's talking about the things they really face because you're stuck in this. Something that Sherry Hunkler was kind of alluding to, we're stuck in the mold of a conversation, stuck in the middle of Congress that has nothing to do with the reality that we face. And the part of the reality we face is that there are two very different visions about America, one with very limited and no government, one with government that really has a role to play in society. And so that's what, and that's the argument that our elected political leaders and our press are not having with us. So I'd like to tackle it from that end when we come back. Let's see what the reality of what we're looking for and what the discussion should be that we're not having. So we're going to break now, or Mr. Producer? Nobody's listening to me across the glass? We're going to break now? All right, so we're going to break, and we're going to come right back with our guest as we look at the fiscal cliff. Don't go away. And Betty, you're the first caller up. We're going to come right to your call when we return. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to a conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com. Or you can click on steinershow.org. Their banner is always there, and all the information for MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We are here with, guests. We're here with Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC, Bob Summerby, Editor of the Daily Howler, Rick Vatz, Dr. Richard Vatz, Distinguished Professor in the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Towson University, and author of the only...
Authentic Book of Persuasion. Thank you.
What's the name of the book?
You already made that joke.
I'm just going to say that every time. It just begs for that rebuttal.
Sherry Hahn, the co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, and former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, Lennon McAllister, conservative media personality, public speaker, and writer, whose work you can see at LennyMcCallister.com. Number here is 410-319-8888. Before we jump back to the question that I raised before break, let's go to our callers. And Betty, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Our country has to have the will. That's the will to serve everybody that's in the serve the full population. When you're talking about the deficit, they need to look at the wars. They need to look at the defense budget. Why do we have to have so many military bases all over the world? Why are we policing the world? That is an awful lot of our budget, the military and the defense budget. It needs to be cut. And one other thing that kind of bothers me, having worked for 34 years, paid into the Social Security system, it's an insult to say to us that we are getting entitlements and these entitlements have to be cut. So I'm really a little stressed out because we talk about if we're so concerned about the deficit, why can't we look at the defense budget, look at all of that waste, and then we won't have a deficit. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much, Betty, for your call. Before we go to the next caller, quick response, then we'll go on to...
Can I respond to that? I mean, the first...
Lenny, go ahead, please.
I think nobody's referring to cutting benefits for people that are about to receive the benefits now. I think that, if you work for 34 years, number one, thank you for just being the type of American that young people need to look up to. But more than that, it's the young people that we're going to have to sit there and say the world's going to have to be different. And we've done this with every single generation of Americans from the end of slavery to the end of Jim Crow to the end of the Cold War. I mean, every generation of Americans grew up with one expectation that shifted on them once they became adults. And so what we're doing is we're saying, listen, those that are far away from getting these benefits, we're going to have to do this differently, but we have a responsibility to do it, be appropriate, do it responsibly, but do it in a way that's going to allow you to continue to have self-perpetuating prosperity as a result. So, in regards to cutting her benefits, I disagree with her saying that. And real quick, in regards to the defense budget, I mean, yeah, I think there's some ways we can look at it and streamline it where necessary, but the bottom line is we have interests all around the world, and those interests help allow us to enjoy the American lifestyle that we have. Now, it's up to us to improve it and spread that self-perpetuating prosperity across the diversity of America, but we have to make sure that we're not making ourselves vulnerable. That's how we got to 9/11 in the first place.
Let me go to Sherry Hunkler for the other side here for a moment.
Okay.
Yeah, hi. I was cut off by the boogeyman, so I...
There's no boogeyman in the studio, but anyway, go ahead.
That's good. So I have no idea what he said, but I can assume what he said, which is probably something about, like, we need to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps if we really want prosperity.
Didn't say that.
Pardon?
I didn't say anything about pulling up by bootstraps. I feel like there are opportunities that folks that are struggling in America are not given a chance to even access the lower rungs of the corporate ladder. And if we don't allow them to at least access the lower rungs, how can we ask them to climb the corporate ladder? We can't. So no, I didn't say that at all.
Well, maybe we could focus on not necessarily having the folks that are on the lower, part of the totem pole focus on climbing the corporate ladder. And maybe we need to begin to teach our children and our communities how to operate more cooperatively. I would be interested in having our schools teach things about cooperation. I would like to see more cooperatives, both in terms of community farms, in terms of cooperative housing, in terms of just overall cooperation and sharing and caring and taking care of our neighbors and all of those kinds of things. We don't really have to live in a country where we're all racing to the top.
You know, the argument was made that we should have less money devoted to defense needs. I don't know how many of you have seen the article by John McCain, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham.
I read it.
Yeah, who says that, well, I can
I detect a tone, but go ahead, Richard, continue.
That's interesting, because I didn't infer anything whatsoever.
No. Maybe I heard wrong. No.
And they argue that abjuring our power in the world yields states like Syria, in which 46,000 and counting are being killed, and that when we lose our influence as the good guys of the world, bad things happen. Now, you can dispute that, but but be specific with respect to what your argument is. Are you arguing that the United States should abdicate its position of power in with respect to foreign policy?
I'm not going to answer it that way, but I will, because that's not the question. Well, the question you have to lay on the table is what I think Lynn McAllister said earlier, and we talked about a military budget and what the role of our military should be, and whether we intend to, with the West, control all the natural resources of the planet Earth with our military might, or do we realize there's only so much to go around and everyone's going to have to live a little differently if we're going to survive on this planet. Our greed for everybody in this room and everybody on this show has a cell phone. You have a cell phone?
I do.
You do. Bob does not have a cell phone. That's what Bob does not have a cell phone. I know that. That's a good thing.
I don't answer the phone I have.
You know, so. Really, that's true. Eventually you get around to it and we find each other, but you do not do that either. But these cell phones are part of the root of the war that are killing millions of people in the Congo, because the West, United States, want to control that wealth coming out of the Congo. So you support regimes like Uganda to send armies in, Rwanda, I mean, to send armies in to help control those mines. That's where our military money is going to. Is that what we want to do with our military money?
Well,
I say no.
Let me tell you, Mark.
I say no. That's part of the problem. We should.
That simplifies the issue, though, because the alternative is never really considered in that question when you hear that argument generally presented. So the alternative could be an extremist regime. Or let's go to the Middle East, an extremist Muslim regime that only believes, and we saw this with the Taliban, that only believes in extremism when it comes to Islam, doesn't believe that girls should go to school, believes that women should have their place, which is silent, and if need be, carved up in their faces and brutalized and all types of things, but yet they're controlling the same resources that we're claiming we want to share around the world. So we're talking about human nature and we're talking about geopolitics. So the bottom line is it us who believes in religious freedom and freedom of speech and things along those lines, or do we take the risk that those resources fall into hands that do not share our beliefs? And I think that a lot of times we take this into an economic matter. People say we should pull back, but they forget the alternative. The alternative could be, 70 years ago, the alternative was Adolf Hitler almost running all of Europe. So it's not as though it can't happen in American history or in global history. So do we have an obligation to try to stem that off as much as possible? I would say yes.
I would just say, in terms of the discussions that have been unfolding or failing to unfold about the whole budget matter, here again, defense is an area. I think it's fair to say defense has not been seriously discussed at all, except for the role it played in the fiscal cliff, where they put defense cuts in to scare themselves. That's the last thing anyone in Congress and either party wants to do. So defense, despite the gigantic size of the American defense budget, defense really, check your big newspapers, it's just not part of the discussion. Richard mentioned Social Security a while, Lenny mentioned Social Security and said we'll have to do it differently in the future. We don't really have, you know, there might be a better way to do it. We don't really have to do it differently, but in our discussions of the last 30 years, there's no area where more misinformation and disinformation has been spread to citizens than in the area of Social Security. So we have one one sclerotic discussion after another in one area. Some things you can't discuss at all. Some things you can only discuss incorrectly. And that's the way our pseudo-discussion fails to ever occur.
And on the way to the phone show, I'll just say, and because I want to come back to what government is supposed to be, and which is the real debate we're not having, I think, in America. But what you were saying earlier, Lenny, about foreign policy, about the military, that's our foreign policy has led to these fundamentalist regimes. It's our policy that led to that. So our policy that installed the Shah of Iran that led to the fundamentalists in Iran. It's our policy that continues to supported Mubarak and on and off supported Gaddafi, that supported the dictators of the Middle East, that led to these revolutions and revolts.
But, Mark, before it was our policies, it was Great Britain's policies in the beginning of the 20th century.
No, exactly, but they're connected.
You cannot remove and just put it exclusively on America.
No, but
this vacuum is throughout human history has been filled by some regimes. Some of them have been more acceptable of different cultures than others. And if you look at global history, the United States of America has been the one that has been most tolerant of diversity. I mean, you can't compare it to Europe. You can't compare it to Rome, I should say. You can't compare. I mean, the UK oppressed at this point in time 100 years ago was oppressing India and other colonies as well as Belgium.
And Mark,
are
you saying without them we would have democracy across the Middle East?
I'm not going that far. What I'm saying is that the only reason that that the U.S. is doing it, not Britain, is because after World War II, U.S. became the power. Mm. Yeah. And then it took over from Britain and France, which took a secondary position, but still worked together. And what I'm talking about, that what
versus
we set up and what we set up,
versus
what the Western world set up, excuse me, what the Western world set up since 1885 throughout the colonial world is what has set up the world up we have today. And unless we realize that, we can't create a policy that changes
that.
But
to say that there are totalitarian regimes because of the United States is a post hoc ergo propter hoc argument. I mean, I accept the United States' interference in these regimes. But to argue that without that, that there would be some sort of democratic rule.
I didn't say that. You keep saying that. I didn't say that.
Well, but if you're not saying that, then what is, then what
I'm
is
not,
the lesson?
I'm saying that we don't have a right to determine what other nations' governments should be.
But you're making an ethical,
period,
not a practical argument.
No, I'm saying that we have created the monster we're looking at.
But that's a different argument. To say that those...
Okay, okay. Stop, Richard. Let's move ahead to this discussion about, is the real issue around the fiscal cliff issues that we don't want to talk about, which is our different visions of what a government should or should not be in the modern world. Sherry?
Well, I think... the first thing that I would do if I was in charge, which is just right around the corner.
I didn't know that.
I'd have a completely different set of cabinet members. Instead of having like a cabinet on defense, I'd have a cabinet on peace. On education, youth and children, yes, I think that a government needs to be set up to provide and to take care of its people and take into account that we have a global economy and we care about the rest of the planet, and it wouldn't even really matter if we cared about the rest of the planet. With the global, with the climate crisis that we have right now, even conservative environmentalists are now sounding the alarm that, you know, we as an entire planet are really in trouble if we don't get our act together in the next 5 years.
Sure. Have you any objection to what is called the nanny state? I mean, does that concept
That's a pejorative term, though.
Well, it's a pejorative term, but the extent to which the government sees its citizens as children to be taken care of.
That's, again, a pejorative way of looking at it.
But do you object to that?
I object to the term.
But
I do, too.
But, I object to the term. we have a responsibility.
We have a nanny state within this group.
We have had messed up priorities for years. We intervene in business that's none of our business all over the entire world. We try to pretend like economics doesn't have anything to do with everything that we do, but everything we do, it has something to do with economics. And we continue to practice U.S. exceptionalism, like we know the best. And you know, it's time for us to stop, to begin experimenting with acting cooperatively with our neighbors, our country, and with the rest of the world.
I also think
I think that those that are quote unquote in love with NAFTA would say that we're cooperating just fine, and that's the reason why plenty of jobs have left the United States. You know,
nobody's in love with NAFTA.
Well, and that's my point. That was sarcasm. that was sarcasm. That's my point. We have tried to say, okay, maybe we can do some things better and more efficient and not do it the way we've always done it in America. And that has consequences as well. So I don't think we have to go to one extreme or the other. I think there is an opportunity,
though.
It's
not an extreme. It's intelligent. We don't need, you know, free or fair trade. We need intelligent trade, like the Ecuadorian people talk about. Where if we don't start thinking about the fact that, you know, we're going to deplete all of the Earth's resources and, you know, set the planet on fire, you know, we have to think about what we're doing and the impact on generations to come.
You have
and everything that we do.
I was just going to comment on, you know, after coming off of a long election from November and hearing so much about how we kind of dip in and out of leaning back on our Judeo-Christian values in this country, that it always seems ironic to me that we divorce ourselves from those values when it comes to talking about how we take care of our citizens or if we decide to take care of our citizens. And so I think... in our own schizophrenia as Americans, trying to decide if we are about the business of caring for others, especially talking about others who aren't able to take care of themselves, or if it is solely about pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps and not being entertaining the idea of caring for others, that we have to have those types of conversations of where we actually are and what is our vision as America. Personally, not even as an academic, personally, I feel like where we are is, politically speaking, is we're all playing the same game. There aren't these divergent voices being heard because no one wants to offer a new perspective. We're saying the same things and just packaging it in different ways so that it happens to have, you know, a black president and his face on one thing and another person's face on another. And so it seems different, but they're saying the same things. There's nothing new. There's nothing in terms of a new vision that's going to carry the country in a different direction than where we are, except in chaos where we are now.
I'm prepared to offer a new vision.
Let's hear it.
Here's my new vision.
Let's hear it.
In terms of the simple, proximate discussion about fiscal matters, I'm very happy to offer this vision. Let's go back to health costs, which are driving our government deficits. Let's go back to health costs and find out who is looting all the money. We spend twice as much per person as France, Germany, more like three times as much as Japan per person on healthcare. Where is all that money going? If, as I said before, if that differential were eliminated, the government would be running surpluses. Right there, that money. Where is that money going? We don't have to make grandma work another year and a half when all that money is disappearing somewhere, and show me the discussion of that question that is you're not allowed to discuss it. It didn't come up for the entire year 2009. There's a lot of money going somewhere. They're not doing it anywhere else in the developed world. Where is it going? Because right there is all this, you know, fiscal disaster we're complaining about. That's my vision. Where is just that money? Where is that money going? Then we'll forget about tax rates on wealthy people and corporations. Forget about other matters. Just forget about where is that money going? There's a question. That question will never be discussed in this country as long as you live. You can get online tomorrow and start looking for that discussion.
Is it because you think you have an answer or because we aren't willing to reveal what the real issues are?
I think I have an answer. I think I know, and I think the answer is one group after another is siphoning off a certain amount of extra money. I mean, everyone's taken their – There isn't one explanation where all that money is going. There are extra procedures being done. Mm-hmm. There is overcharging going on. Equipment makers charge too much. There's all kinds. You know, it's going, as with everything in our society, everyone's grabbing a big chunk of change, and no one, because they're campaign contributors, no one says a word. That's the answer. And big newspapers don't want to talk about it. I'm still not sure why that is. But it's an obvious question. Go ahead. Get online tomorrow and try to find the discussion. Go ahead. Just try
While we're talking about competing visions. Let me
try to get a call in here before you end the hour. Will help.
But that money, can I say, the money's going to the rich.
410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
How are you doing today? Happy New Year's, Mr. Steiner.
Happy New Year to you, Hank.
Here's my thing, right? I never knew what the physical cliff was because as far as I'm concerned, I've always been hanging on a cliff, right? The day that I don't get out and go hop for my own food or can my own food, right, or teach me or my children how to be self-sufficient, hanging off of a cliff, right? We put so much value into what we have or what someone else has that we fail to realize the most important thing, right? All that is guaranteed to us in life, it's the fact that we're going to die, right? And that we are animals, right? I'm jumping off the subject a little bit, right? We as human beings, as men, right? We call it mammals. We call it primates. We call it Homo sapiens, right? But what we never call ourselves is animals because we have thumbs, opposable thumbs, and a mind which thinks, right? Well, monkeys have the same opposable thumb. And what if they decided that they were a little bit more intelligent than us and wanted to give up, right? I look at so many television shows on the Discovery Channel, and almost at the end of every show at the Discovery Channel, you know what they say about the jungle? The most feared animal in the jungle doesn't even come from the jungle. It comes from the city. It's man, right? We go into the jungle and we kill everything in it, and we call it us the top of the food chain when we really, really aren't, right? Because something's going to take us over. We're going to wind up getting rid of ourselves, right? Worrying about how much more can I extract from everyone else instead of worrying about, hey, look, this is the place that I would like to be, but I'm here. And now I'd like to leave it for somebody else to see just how beautiful it is. So let me not tear it up.
I think you raise an issue. Let me just get some final thoughts here from our panel. Hank, because what you just raised. Sherry, what Hank was saying is not too far from what you were saying earlier in the show.
I think Hank was talking about it's important to get me in mind. And I think that what I'm trying to say is that everything that we have rests on our that we've gotten from our ancestors, whether it's Social Security, 40-hour work week, a right to vote, you name it. And I think that we have a responsibility to the next generation to just increase the rights that we have in this country, and we need to learn how to share and take care of each other.
I think I just want to say that my competing vision is probably at odds with three or four members of this panel, but I would summarize it in two words. I think the country should work to minimize dependency.
A final thought, Lenny?
I concur with that. I think that primarily what we need to do is create opportunities for self-perpetuating prosperity across the diversity of America, not just with the middle class.
I agree that dependency is not a good thing.
I don't
see there's a lot of new dependency going on. I have to say that. I don't see there's
the American with Disabilities Act?
The increase in food stamps, that's an increase in dependency.
Yeah. And without food stamps, a lot of people would have no food on the table in America.
I'm not saying they shouldn't have it. I'm saying that people are struggling. So there is definitely an increase of dependency. We got to turn that around. That's what I'm saying.
32 to 45 million. He's right.
Jobs in this country, for God's sakes. We don't need to starve people.
Right.
We need a Green New
Deal. He's not arguing that.
But that's why people need food stamps, because jobs aren't here. That's the point.
People aren't living high off the hog on $200 a month.
They we're not saying that. We're saying we need to create more jobs. That's all we're saying.
Right. We're talking past each other at the moment.
One of the conversations talking about jobs and green economy, I think we should have in this show, is a proposal a friend of mine created out of Wyoming, which is really interesting. It would cost a huge amount of government investment, but also to move the private sector along. And it's something that I'm vetting with some people who actually know things about technology and energy and if it's even feasible. And one of the things he said when I said green energy, he said, forget windmills. Just close with this thought. We'll think about this and come back another day. He said, if America spent the next 20 years building solar panels beneath the grid of America, all of it, and is reworking our grid to modernize the grid technologically, we could free ourselves of oil to fuel America outside of our cars. That if we invested in America, invested in solar panels all connected to the grid, it would change the nature of energy in 20 years in this country. Something to think about. And when I finish with the paper and get it out to folks, I'm actually going to give it to some senators and congressmen saying, what about this idea?
That would minimize dependency.
But it means government has to invest hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 20 years to make it work. Is that worth it? I would say I think so. I want to thank all of our guests. Sherry Hunkla, who is co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which is where I first met her 20 years or so ago, former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, has been with us. Dr. Richard Vatz, distinguished professor in the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Towson University, who wrote the only book on something earlier. Well, whatever that's called.
None of us are getting straight on this book.
Oh, God. Yeah, say the title, Rick.
The only authentic book of persuasion.
Just look in the V's.
Bob Thornby, editor of the Daily Howler. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC. Lenny McAllister at LennyMcAllister.com, commentator and public speaker and writer. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. The Mark Satter Show here is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. Reminding you again to call 410-454-0500 or go to hfishman@bizjournals.com. 410-454-0500 to get tickets to join us for the Annapolis Summit, January 9th. You have your chance yourself to interview and ask questions of the governor, president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House. And I want to thank all of you for being with us today, all of our guests. It's been a really interesting 2 hours. Mark Satter's show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Malronis. Our engineer tonight is Andrea Melton. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find any information about our guests and even the books that they write, please visit on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.